It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're down to the final fortnight before the deadline for the state legislature to pass a budget. While legislators work through those issues, House transportation hearings continue, and there's the possibility of a liquor privatization bill moving on the Senate side. It's time now for our weekly political chat, and I'm joined now by phone from Harrisburg by John Micek. He is longtime political capital reporter for the Patriot News. John Micek, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Thank you for joining us. And also, Terry Madonna is professor of public relations at Franklin Marshall College. Terry, good to have you back on the program with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the budget, gentlemen. And Terry Madonna, why don't you start by breaking it down for us, where some of the sticking points might be and some of the key areas that legislators are focusing on here in these final 2 weeks leading up to the deadline.
All right. Well, the House sent the budget along straight party votes over to the Senate last week. Not a single Democrat voted for the House. All 92 Democrats didn't cast a single vote for the Republican budget.
Which is unusual, right?
Yeah. I mean, historically in the past, they would make sort of deals during the Rendell years when the Republicans controlled the legislature for six of the 8 years in which Rendell was governor. They got into a room and worked out deals, and Republicans would get some of their priorities and Democrats would get theirs. And the responsibility then for the minority party, in this case the Democrats, during those years was to provide some votes, usually leadership votes, but, you know, some votes for the passage of the budget. So it's clear that the Senate is not going to just simply, state Senate, not adopt the 2.1% increased budget the House sent over to the Senate. They'll have slightly different priorities, but the big takeaway, and I think there are two of them. One, the budget will not call for any new tax hikes or of any consequence, probably no tax hikes at all. We'll see about certain kinds of fees. The other, and it won't deviate very much from the overall spending that the House sent to the Senate, but there will be a pretty vigorous debate over the education part of the budget, which was, during the course of the debate in the House, the most focused upon area of the budget. So I think we might see some effort by Republicans in the Senate to slightly increase the education side, education spending, given the layoffs, given what we're now finding out about what's taking place in the 500 school districts across the state.
John Micek, it looks like the deadline will be met, but it's interesting when Terry talks about this budget issue being so divisive that not one Democrat is on board in the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, this is a sort of the embodiment of the polarization that's gone on between legislative Democrats and the Corbett administration now into its third year. And Terry is right. I mean, the sticking point here is spending on public schools and spending on public education. You're looking at layoffs in the Philadelphia school district. There's 76 people, I think, got handed pink slips there last week. Democrats held a press conference outside the lieutenant governor's office last week as well to decry public education cuts in the Corbett budget. They say this is taking place, even as the administration hands hundreds of million dollars of tax cuts to corporations in forms of reduction to the state's corporate net income tax and the phasing out of the capital stock and franchise tax. They think these are misplaced priorities. I'd be curious to see if, in fact, Governor Corbett does meet his June 30th deadline. He's actually held up with the possibility of working into July to try to extract some of his legislative agenda as well.
And as these issues come up, particularly with regard to how the public will perceive a lack of education funding at the, expense of giving tax breaks to corporations, as an example, how is that going to play in the run-up to the election? Because you would have to think in these partisan times that is something that every member of the administration and certainly in the legislature is taking into consideration at this point.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that the governor's low job performance, and at this point in his governorship, he has the lowest job approval of any governor in modern history, has to do with several budget years in which he's recommended cuts to school districts, higher education, and county human services. These are three popular program areas that have a lot of constituent groups and supply a lot of the jobs in the state. So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, unless the education budget is increased a bit, and if these layoffs continue, I don't think that's going to help the governor's job approval, and it's certainly going to be a huge issue for Democrats. Democrats, during the hearings last week in the House, which shows you that I have no life because I ended up listening to the final budget for about only John Misek and me, I think, would listen to this. I listened to it, and over again, it was education, education. You know, they got off on Medicaid a bit. That was an issue, and sometimes the environment. But John Misek's right. I mean, basically, it's what many perceive to be a big dislocation to schools that is at the heart of it. And I think that's going to be a huge issue in the gubernatorial campaign as it unfolds.
John Misek, the House transportation hearings continue today. Where do things stand? And I understand that former Governor Ed Rendell jumped into the fray on the transportation plan before the House.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, Governor Rendell has always been a proselytizer for this. In his post-political life, he runs this political action committee with Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York City, pushing for improved infrastructure spending. And that was something he spent a fair amount of time and energy on in his last 2 years. But, yeah, this is one of those big three sort of tentpole issues. The Senate sent over last week a three-year, $2.5 billion transportation funding bill that includes money for road and bridge reconstruction, mass transit agencies, and other sort of forms of infrastructure, airports, railroads, that kind of thing. It is funded in the main by lifting the wholesale tax paid by gas stations, along with bumps to motor vehicle license and registration fees, and also pretty controversially a $100 surcharge on moving violations. So if you get a $100 ticket just for or $150 ticket for the sake of argument for speeding, bam, that becomes a $250 ticket. There's a great deal of resistance among Republican members of the House to vote for any sort of tax and or fee increase in the run-up to an election. Mm-hmm. You know, the Corbett administration claims that by lifting this wholesale gasoline tax that, you know, there's not going to be any pass-through at the pumps. But I think that's a hopelessly naive worldview. If somebody's costs go up, that will inevitably be passed along to motorists. So that's sort of the calculus in the House right now. The governor's plan is a lot more cautious. 5 years, $1.8 billion, relies only on the lifting of the wholesale gasoline tax. And, you know, they're kind of deadlocked on this right now.
And doesn't that defeat, if you're looking at renewable energy as your future source of energy, or at least developing those things, even if you raise the gas tax, for example, there doesn't seem to be too much of a resistance to the fees, because apparently they haven't been raised in a while.
10 years.
So,
yeah.
So people might be willing to go along with that. The surcharge, as you said, John, it sounds like no way, certainly not with Republican legislators. They're not on board with that. But as far as the gas tax, Terry Madonna, I mean, if we're moving toward renewable energy and people become less reliant on fossil fuels, how much money is that gas tax going to provide if that's something we're moving away from?
Well, that's right. I mean, the obvious problem is the more we use renewables, and who knows where we're going to go with natural gas. I mean, there's this assumption at some point automobiles will use natural gas once they get the infrastructure for that worked out. That just brings in less money. Now, in the defense of just to present the other point of view, the $1.85 was set, I think, before the fall of the Roman Empire. So it's not as though, you know, it's not as though this is an adjustment that's been made within the last decade or two. I mean, that figure was set a long, long time ago. And the other point I would mention is that last week, Barry Shoke, the Secretary of Transportation, did indicate that the governor was flexible about what he would sign. So my sense is that he would sign anything between, as John points out, the $1.8 billion that Governor Corbett wants and the $2.5 Senate plan, something in between there. And he probably would be willing to close his eyes to the Norquist pledge that he signed, meaning no taxes or fee hikes, and sign a bill that would contain an increase in the wholesale gas tax as well as the fees for motor license registrations, licenses and registration increases. I think he would sign it. But there is a battle going on in the House among Republicans right now about whether to do a transportation bill or not. There is a group of House members that want to do an infrastructure bill. So the fight is within the Republican caucus at the moment in the House as to whether they can get the 103 votes necessary to approve a transportation bill.
And Paul, if I could,
yeah, go ahead, John.
One of the bones of contention here is that the $100 million that would be raised by the ticket surcharge would go to mass transit agencies. So there's a lot of consternation among, say, rural Republicans. Why should we vote for this bill when why should we vote for this ticket surcharge when all the money is, and this is the course you get all the time, when all of that money is going to be channeled to the Port Authority of Pittsburgh or to SEPTA in Philadelphia. So that's a sticking point as well.
Yeah, one other point about that. That's the reason that the House unveiled, I think it was, maybe John can help me out here, last week or the week before, an interactive map that shows individual lawmakers what projects they will get. There's now an assumption that in order to get the votes, they have to go to House Member A or House Member B and say, okay, this is what you're going to get. If you vote for this bill, these are the improvements you will get in your district. These are the bridges you'll get repaired. This is the road improvements you will get. So I think they're a little mindful, as John accurately points out, that in order to get rural Republican lawmakers on board, they have to show that they're getting something out of it in order to get their vote.
In fact, it's a three-tiered map. It's what you get with nothing. It's what you get with the Corbett plan, and it's what you get with the Senate bill, and it's color-coded. And it's actually fascinating to see how much that stuff diminishes, with the less that they spend, obviously.
Right, and it's been a hot issue, and anything that really drives the point home, I'm sure, with their constituents is something that legislators are happy to see. We're talking politics with longtime Capitol reporter for the Patriot News, John Micek, and also Terry Madonna, professor of public affairs at Franklin and Marshall College. It's 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The time is moving quickly, and we have a lot of other points to hit. There is legislation in the Pennsylvania Senate that would diminish the power of the Allegheny County Executive, Rich Fitzgerald, when it comes to Port Authority transit. It's a bill brought forth by Senate President Pro Tem Joe Scarnati. John Micek, what can you tell us about this bill?
I confess not having the greatest familiarity with it, but I sort of got a crash course when I was standing in a very crowded Senate Appropriations Committee meeting last week. But in essence, I think changed the makeup of the board of directors of the Port Authority and to some extent diminishing the clout of Allegheny County Exec Rich Fitzgerald. I mean, that is sort of my sort of layman's knowledge of that. But I can say that it was really vigorously debated, and you saw a great deal of back and forth between Senator Scarnati, who is a Republican from Jefferson County, and your own state Senator Jim Furlow there, the Democrat from Pittsburgh. They went 12 rounds over this over the course of this meeting. It's obviously quite hotly contested. There's a lot of clout invested in that agency. A whole lot of people depend on the Port Authority to get to work. So you can understand how that would be an emotional issue.
And Terry Madonna, you're saying this is not anything that's particularly unusual.
No. What this bill would do would be to put literally five of the 11 members of the PAT would be Harrisburg-based, state-based. Each of the legislative leaders would get the name one person. The governor would get the name person. One person out of the 11, county council will get to name a few, and of course the county executive. But here's the big takeaway. This is very common when it comes to state boards and state commissions. Take the current gaming board, 7 members, 4 of them are each of the legislative caucus leaders has an appointee. So 4 of the 7 out of the legislature, 3 from the governor. You can go around the state, no matter what, and some of them are there by virtue of their office. For example, if you take the Turnpike Commission, the Secretary of Transportation is a permanent member of that commission. This does 2 things. Number one, it diversifies the board in this case, meaning the members are drawn from a variety of sources. And the second thing that it does, it puts Harrisburg, in other words, the state capital, into the mix. That can be good and it could be bad. The good point is, on one level, you get people appointed by the caucuses and the governor who become advocates, in this case, for the authority, advocates. Or if the governor's mad at you or the legislative leaders are mad at what they're doing out there, they could appoint people who are going to try to bring about change. So I've seen both of those occur over the years.
Another member of Governor Corbett's administration is out. Richard Allen, the head of the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, was forced to resign. What happened there, John Micek?
It was revealed that Secretary Allen had sent out sort of a racially charged email about somebody within the agency. That became an instant liability. The governor asked for and received his resignation late last week. We've now seen five cabinet-level departures within 3 years in the Corbett cabinet, which, you know, that kind of turnover is not unprecedented, but you know, it's the sort of turnover that he's had. The health secretary, Eli Avila, who is a controversial figure for a number of reasons, he left. Gary Alexander, the public welfare secretary, he sort of left under a cloud. He was charging the taxpayers for his commutes back and forth to his home in Rhode Island. Mr. Avila was best known for an incident with a restaurant owner in Harrisburg where he got upset over the quality of an egg sandwich and actually pulled one of those "don't you know who I am" moments. his claim to fame.
Yeah, people in restaurants love that when that happens.
Oh, they really, that's how you get sneezers. But you know, it's not uncommon to see this kind of turnover, but sort of the way that it's happened and with the governor's approval ratings where they are, you know, it's not really anything he needs right now.
And Terry Madonna, you know, Governor Corbett is barely halfway through his term, and John is saying it's not terribly unusual.
Correct.
but you know, how does this reflect on the governor at the end of the day?
Well, you know, if he had a job performance 55 or 60%, I mean, cabinet officers come and go. I think Rendell had more turnover at this point in his tenure than Governor Corbett has. But having said that, if things are moving along swimmingly, if everything is going great, you got a job performance above 50%, you're working out deals, the voters are happy with you, no one probably cares. And you can replace cabinet officers who are not exactly, you know, I haven't gone into a diner yet and said, or a restaurant saying, "Do you know who I am?" But you get the point.
Even though you're on NPR, Terry.
Yeah, but you don't. But, you know, people don't have generally the public doesn't know the particular cabinet officers unless they're in, you know, in the news a good bit. But the bigger point is this: where he is now, given his standing, you know, 25-35% job performance on the positive side, he doesn't need this. John's exactly right. You don't need this because now it becomes an issue of leadership, of management, of governance, things that you don't raise if things are going well.
We've been talking politics, and our contributors, John Micek, Capitol reporter for the Patriot News, and Terry Madonna, professor of public affairs at Franklin and Marshall College. Gentlemen, we've come to time. Thank you so much for a very informative segment. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Coming up, we'll hear how newly identified genetic markers may predict who will respond to breast cancer prevention therapy. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.